So we're just bouncing back into this other world where if you have this separation of subjectivity and objectivity, which is deeply ingrained in us, right? I haven't really gone into the power of the hold that that has on us. Because if you think about it and you try and give some kind of account of what's going on here, I'd just like to give it a little bit of defense. Then you do the science. Then what I'm talking about here, this amazing moment that of now, the being of now, every single thing that I'm experiencing now, I'm fairly confident could be traced back to events that are happening in here. You know, the firing of neurons that are causing my jaw to vocal cords. My seeing, I can only see this room because I've got eyes, because I've got a visual cortex. The visual cortex is assimilating it all into some kind of signal to the frontal lobes. The whole thing is a phenomenon occurring in my brain. Do you see that? This phenomenon obviously isn't the same as my brain, which is all neurons firing, because I'm experiencing colours and sounds and blah, blah, blah. So obviously all this is happening in something like consciousness. And my brain, in certain sense, that is obviously utterly connected up with this experience, has its being in some kind of physical place that isn't at all like the experience I'm having, even though every single thing that I experience seems to be dependent on this brain, because if I start to destroy it, then I destroy my experience. Do you see, as soon as you think about it, you say, well, so what is going on? It looks like there is an objective world out there and a subjective mind or consciousness that I'm experiencing all on my own, all to myself, nobody else is seeing exactly what I'm seeing. You know, nobody's sitting in this chair looking out like I'm looking out. I just want to bump back, because I want to bump you back to in a way to say, do you see how gripping this understanding is? This as soon as we think about it, we can't help but separate it like this. I'd like you all to feel uncomfortable about this. Uncomfortable in a way of just sort of recognizing, well, I don't really know what's going on. We don't, do we?
It doesn't really matter.
It is, isn't it?
It's what it is.
It's
I open my eyes and I see blue here, white there, yellow there. Already I'm starting to make a thing, because it's not all the same. It's not all the same. What we see out there is not all the same. Therefore, it must be that, you know, I don't know, even the perception of that I am perceiving, and that's not all the same. I mean, you know.
But do you see, the whole thing is just, for me, it's just occurring in what something I call consciousness, which is all made out of these ineffable qualities, colour experiences, sounds, the sort of sensation of sitting on the chair. They're all, none of them is physical. It's an utterly immaterial, I don't even know what to call it. Yeah, and it's within that I perceive what I take to be physical things. And it would all be fine. It would all be a lovely, like, oh, well, it's all right. We're just kind of having a movie. And until you lose an arm or a leg or you have a stroke. you know, until you see
I feel like you say, oh fuck,
this body, I'm totally dependent on it. No body, no experience. That there's something appearing in this, you know, it'd be nice, this dream, that this dream only lasts as long as something within the dream is functioning. Do you see what a weird, you couldn't dream it up, could you? What the predicament we're in. I'm only saying that because we're kind of bouncing over, the subject-object, you know, duality or relation, as if it's just something that we can idly think about. It's just a concept, as if it doesn't bite, as if we don't really spend a large part of our life, especially when we're watching scientific documentaries or we're thinking philosophically, accepting this division as something that... and I know what happens when you come back to now is you don't really have an answer to that. All you can say is something like this. All I know for sure is that I'm here having this experience. I don't know what the brain is. I don't know how the experience is being generated. Mm-hmm. I'm just unaware of it. Perched here, maybe over some abyss. So that's the background, and then you, within that, then you have this idea of relativism, which says that there isn't any meaning to any text. You know, we're going along now. We're saying, so we're all our individual consciousnesses, and the meaning of the text only manifests when somebody reads it. But when somebody reads it, a totally new meaning occurs every time. So where's the meaning of the text? You know, and this is, you know, I can't read postmodern philosophy, but I think postmodernism has wandered into this area, right? Who's in charge of the narrative? Who's to say what the text means? Does the text mean anything? Or does it just mean what you experience it to mean?
You sort of riff off what's there, don't you? So there's stuff probably you could say, what does it not mean? And you can't twist it to the point that it will mean the opposite of what's intended, but you're sort of building on it as well, so it's collaborative, isn't it?
But you can come to some quite extraordinary... It must be almost infinite from a, you know, especially something like... literature, what you could take it to mean. The thing with relativism is it's saying that there actually is no, the text has no meaning aside from its realization in each one of us. Do you see that's its, and it's a bit existential in a way. Do you see it's got an existential turn to it, which where you say, well, that's great. Nothing means anything, it's up to me.
But it's to do with the author communicating with the reader, isn't it? The author's communicating. Yeah. The author writes the book to be heard, either through a story or a biography or whatever they write, and that's their way of communicating with the world, the bigger world, from the author's perspective.
Yes.
They want, and you understand they're wanting to communicate something, you know, about something, and they've got a theme that they want to communicate, either through story, biography, or I don't know, anything really, and they want to tell the bigger part. They don't just want to tell their friend want to tell the world about that.
But if you think about, let's take a more in this poll.
And you understand that, and you might, I might read that book, and Anthony might read that book, and we'll both get a similar theme, possibly, from that book, that communicated something in a, which was perhaps more, you know, it was important to the whole of humanity to read.
But in the background, aren't you thinking there, in this way that we're talking, that there is some meaning in the work?
Yes.
And what we're saying here is, well,
the author's got their meaning. They want to.
But is that really the case? Is
in
that
language and words?
But is that really the case? Is the author sitting there writing the words down?
Well, they have a desire to do that, don't they? They have an inspiration to do that.
Think of what you're saying now and what I'm saying now. The words are just emerging, right?
But they have an inspiration within, otherwise they wouldn't write the book.
And they reread their text and reorganize.
But you're assuming, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but you're assuming that there's some sort of pre-existent meaning that they're now putting into words.
Well, no, they're another human being. I see it. They're another human being writing the book or writing the text.
But, I'm trying to give you the idea of what relativism is saying, and we're not agreeing with it, we're just wanting to understand it.
Right.
Is that the meaning that the author receives from what's been written is just as relevant as yours?
So there is something here. The meaning of what?
Yeah. There isn't any.
The what is primordial.
But the relativism is saying there's just a bunch of words that have no meaning, and then somebody reads the words,
yeah.
And a meaning forms,
yeah.
And the that's it. There's no meaning in the work. The only meaning is the meaning that forms in you as you read it,
mm-hmm.
And in you and in you and in you, and there was a meaning in the person who wrote it,
yes.
But that's not a special meaning.
Can we travel?
No, I'm a bit confused. I'm getting a little bit confused here about what you're.
What's the special meaning?
Well, the special meaning being the one true meaning. But there isn't.
Saying it has to be a one true.
No,
meaning.
No.
It has the first meaning.
No, I'm just describing relativism.
So
that says the work has no meaning in itself.
Is that what relativism says?
Yes.
But when it's dormant in between people, it doesn't.
Well, no.
You're saying that you were saying earlier, Nicolette, that you could form a meaning and talk to somebody else, and you could make your meanings correspond a bit more.
Mm.
Well, then you've got two similar meanings.
It's still a belief system that you then take on board and
have to. Well, all we're looking at here is what is meaning? Where does it have its being?
Right. Yeah.
And you're saying it has its being in the author.
As well as the reader.
And somebody else might be saying it has its being in the work itself. And relativism is saying, well, it has its being in the experience of anyone who reads it.
Yeah.
And that there's no, that means that there is no one meaning.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. But it means more than that. It means that you're completely, I don't know. My completely wacky meaning, it's not, who's to say it's wacky? There's no standard by which you could say, oh, you're way off. I'm not way off. This is just what happened in me when I read the text.
Right.
Relativism says there's no, at a deep level, it says the truth is whatever you say it is. And if you say it's white and I say it's black, then it's true for you that it's white and it's true for me that it's black. And beyond that, there's no third thing out here where the truth lies. It is, in effect, it's saying there is no truth.
Yeah.
And if we take it into the area of understanding a text, it says the text has no meaning. All we really have are our individual experiences, that each one is as true as everyone else's. I don't know if you might start to vaguely recognise something about our culture here.
Yeah.
Yes?
She was talking about impeachment before, we were laughing, but that's exactly what Trump's lawyer, the constitutional lawyer, was arguing. That Trump, his action, we're not talking about text now, but his action actually was to do with him looking after the country and wanting to safeguard the country. So even though he did what he did, and it looks to others that he was wanting to look after himself for his election, the fact that he was thinking election equals country, me winning means taking care of the country, means I am okay, you know, and that's exactly what the lawyer argued.
Well, it's a
clever
reframing of the whole situation.
Yes.
And nobody could argue with that, because it was, he's saying, well, this is my world, you know, this is how I...
So that's his world, or he's made out that
and
that's
anybody's,
his world.
If you're saying something else, or seeing something else, that's your world. You know.
Yes.
So
but they're all equal.
Yeah.
And this is,
and, but there's a deep sense... You know, to do with morality, that there is no ultimate right or wrong. It's all up to each individual. We're back into existentialism. You can create your own moral framework. You can create your own view of how reality is. You can do anything you like.
Explain this slide then. Go through this slide and
explain it. So there is another possibility if we think in the framework of the subject-object separation, which is that no matter what the author may have had in mind, the meaning of the text is now simply whatever subjective response arises in the mind of the reader. In which case, understanding is certainly not reproductive, as in attempting to reproduce what was in the mind of the author. The reader's understanding no longer supposedly reproduces what the author had in mind, but is simply whatever subjective experience is occasioned in the reader's mind by his or her experience of reading the text. So instead of one meaning, there will be many. It no longer even makes sense to refer to the meaning of the text.
I have a question. So when we say the meaning, do we mean the meaning as it happens, or the meaning as it's supposed to be?
Yes.
Like, I read a poem and I go like, hang on, this is what I think the meaning is, but let me read the commentary and see what the actual meaning is according to people who understand more than me.
Yes.
Then I read and I compare it to the meaning that arose, and I go, oh, maybe this is more convincing, so I should stick to this.
Yes.
So I get a meaning...
And then in the back of your mind, isn't there an idea that the text has a meaning?
Yes.
That somewhere, we're back in the first model, which is the author had a meaning in mind. Maybe even further than that, maybe the psychic entity that communicated to the author had a meaning in mind that even the author wasn't aware of, but the text has a meaning in it. You need some help to arrive at what it is.
Yeah, there is a school of criticism called formalism that completely removed the author and the history of the author and who wrote it and focus on the text itself, regardless of the history and psychology. But there's another school of who only investigate the author and their diaries and everything in order to understand the meaning. And there's another school of intertextualism. They think that the meaning of a text should only be understood in comparison with other texts.
Yeah.
So when you read, if you want to understand the meaning, you should read similar texts to this text, so that you kind of construct the meaning of it. So here we're lost.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's it. It's called the labyrinth. Once you're in, You think, whoa.
Well, you do read something and you might not understand it.
Any of it could be true. Do you see, do you notice the labyrinth there where on all of those, and this is philosophy, right? Finally, analytic philosophy ends up like this. There are a bunch of positions about the basic nature of reality, doesn't really matter which one you take to be true. There's a bunch of positions you can take about the meaning of the text, not that it doesn't really matter, but there is just no truth. There's no this is true and that's not true. There are certain criteria where you can say that the cup is, you can say actually false things about, usually it has to come down to perceptual reality. There are some things that we basically agree on as being false. But even then, there's a famous phrase, there's no assertion so crazy that some philosopher won't support it. I mean, some philosophers enjoy taking the most extreme position imaginable and finding reasons or ways to justify it. If you actually look into, I did courses at the University of Queensland on time and causation, and they're both the same. Basically, they come up and say there are all these positions you could take to understand time, and they're all equally valid. And there are all these positions you could take with cause and effect, and they're all equally valid. The behind that is the there's only one truth. There's no truth. And in a way, that's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, and none of the meanings have meaning unless it's within the context of what you're useful. Like, if you, like your boiler manual, so if everybody's meaning is equally valid, then they're likely to blow themselves up if they haven't understood it fully, so... So therefore, saying that everybody's is equally valid means that nobody's is valid, because is valid. What does that mean?
There's a point where you can say, this is where logical positivism ended up, saying, well, all you can meaningfully talk about is the cup is on the table. If you can actually verify what you're saying by some physical situation in the world, then you're talking sense. If you say anything else, like, what's the meaning of that text? You're talking nonsense. Every position like that sort of always has its logical, obvious contradiction in it. And if you want to know the contradiction of logical positivism, it was the principle of verification. Something only has meaning if it can be verified empirically. The argument against that is, well, the principle of verification can't be verified empirically. End of logical positivism. And relativism says the only truth is that there's no truth. Well, that's a truth. Do you see, every position finally comes down to assert something that's true. You can't avoid it. The best position to be in is the only truth is that there's no truth, and even that might not be true. which I suggest, in a way, collectively as a culture, that's intellectually more or less where we've arrived at.
But this seems purposefully provocative. It's almost absurd, because it can't be true. I know there's no truth, but it seems as though if you were to bring the author and the author's intention into this, then you would have some resolution, because it's the relative position of the author's experience, the reader's experience, and the text.
But I'm come in, Bob, right? Bob Dylan. Hey guys, I've just got my what was it? That prize.
Nobel.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I'm writing all this stuff, you know, right back in the 60s, and I don't know what's happening. I just strum my guitar and this stuff comes out of my mouth. You know, I don't know what it means. What do you mean? What it means? I just sing it, man.
That's not the author, though.
What do you... Well, I get the royalties. No. I mean, I get the royalties. That means I'm the author. I'm pretty sure I'm the man, you know, on the label. Bobby Zimmerman, anyway, you know, originally.
But he's not the author, though. So, the author was...
I'm staying in character, man. Who wrote my songs, man, if I didn't do that?
It was the person, in the recording, it was the person that sings the mic that day in the recording. Now, we have an idea of who that person was, and we need to keep that idea in mind when we read the text. It's from that we have an idea what the text means, and we find meaning in the text. If Bob Dylan didn't sing Blowing in the Wind, and it was someone else, meaning would change. And having that anchor point of that author is how we can share meaning.
But say, someone like Bob, if I can speak for him, I mean, I genuinely think for quite a few of his songs, he just said, he's something like, it was a stream of consciousness stuff. He said,
yeah,
that's an interesting phrase. I'm just putting this down because I want it to be like this. I just want it to evoke stuff in you,
yeah,
man. I don't care what stuff. It's just going to evoke stuff.
If
it'll be fun.
On the right hand side of the brain,
yeah.
It sounds like it. It's like,
yeah,
sort of bypassing the logical
filter. Yeah.
And then that's valid in itself, isn't it? That's an authorial position.
Yeah, but now we're coming back and we're saying, so we've got another author here who really thinks that they've got an intention to communicate something. And what relativism is saying, well, sure, that was just a kind of a certain thing going on in that person at that time. That's what they thought, but it doesn't change anything about relativism. Just because they intended their work to only have one meaning doesn't mean it does.
No, I'm not saying that.
And doesn't mean that the meaning that they thought the work had is the meaning. Does it? Why would it?
Say it again.
It, just because they intended the work to have one meaning,
yeah,
doesn't mean it has that one meaning. If you, and not only that, within this world of relativism, you could never even discover what that was anyway.
But if you can identify there's an intention in meaning, like I intended to have this meaning,
yeah,
but you're saying there's no way to communicate that.
But I intended it to have this meaning.
Yeah.
Do you see where we've already come along a path where we've acknowledged that meaning only exists in the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with
so if some author here says, well, I'm basically there is saying I'm intending everyone who ever reads this to have this meaning. It's absurd.
But all I'm saying is that there's something in the relationship between the reader and the author which allows you to synthesize a proximity. Yeah, an approximation, sorry, of the intended meaning. Without you never be able to experience the intended meaning, but you can have an approximation.
There's some degree of shared experience,
yeah,
that allows you to replicate some, not replicate.
I know you. What you're doing, I think, what we're doing here is we're arguing against relativism.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. But when what I'm doing is I'm trying to explain what relativism is.
Let me.
Yes.
Just saying about relativism, I'm a bit. He's just using it as a. Bortoff is using it to make a point. Is that?
He's making a point because an awful lot of literary criticism lives in this area.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a bit easy to understand.
Yes.
Well, you know,
because it feels like it's floating in the nothing.
I think would tell you that not all works of art are the same. There's a true work of art, and there's a false work of art. A true work of art is a work of art that has only one meaning, and it represents a true meaning.
You're causing me, because reading this, I've had my own view, which is a little bit like that. That in certain circumstances, you might say that there is once we introduce the idea that there's a human psyche, behind experience, there's something like a human psyche, like Jung was saying, like what he considered to be the collective unconscious. And there's stuff there in the collective unconscious that, in a way, can communicate with us. And an artist can pick up on that and attempt to put something out here that in a way is an attempt to put you back in touch with something back there. And I think that would be a picture of what you would think of as a true work of art, because it's, instead of saying there's a cup on the table, it's saying there's something in the psyche. And I'm going to try and use language to point you in the right direction, but once you get within the, if you like, within the orbit of that, which is in the psyche, then you'll be able to, my words won't matter, right? I'm more trying to delineate something that you can see for yourself, and that really is how can I put this? It's still not a meaning, but it has its own being. It has its own, it's a source of meaning. Maybe that's a better way of putting it.
That tapping into the source.
Yeah.
Tapped into the source.
Yes.
But the meaning is feeling, is
it? Well, the meaning again. I mean, I'm with Bortov here. The meaning, the only meaning we know, is meaning now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. As soon as we start thinking that there's a meaning in the psyche or there's a meaning in the author's mind in 1860. We're gone downstream, right? The only meaning that we know, that we ever know, is now.
Can I just my head is it's kind of, and I you probably notice this. I go back to some experience, you know, something. I went to see Death of a Salesman recently. And I've read the play several times, you know, text, and it was a really good story. But on the stage, in that moment, there was this feeling of sadness at the human condition about, you know, the fact that, I don't know if you know the story, we're working, where everything is futile, and it wasn't to do with so much. I became aware of this in the theatre. The sadness came out. I thought, it's not the words. It's something about the whole relationship, words, people, everything. And when you say the psyche, that wasn't about the psyche. That was suddenly being in the human condition, as you know, as I know it, or resonating with something about that. That was very
so where
sad.
Is where is Which, where's so the human condition where would that? If it's not in the psyche, then where is the human condition?
Well, I don't know. I'm not putting anything onto it, because I don't know. I'm just describing an experience now which says
I'm
thinking what
that, you know, Marina, that's what I'd mean by the psyche.
Yeah.
When you say human experience, you mean collectively, don't you? You mean
it was about all of us.
Yes.
It wasn't just that story.
So that's the collective unconscious, isn't it? Where if you like, if there is such a place, it's the storehouse of all experience of life on earth.
Mm.
So when you that's what I mean by art connecting back to some truth that's in there, which you could say it's ineffable, right? You can't. That's why you have to have a play, or a text, or a piece of art, to try and express it out here. But what it's trying to express is something that you can't express, except you have to do. You have to make the play, and then when you make the play, it connects you back to what you were saying.
Mm.
So when you said it's not part of the psyche.
No, I'm saying I'm not claiming anything.
Yes.
I'm just saying all I want to share is that experience, which I found strange, considering I've read the play, you know, so I knew the story. It was like, it was not about, those words were secondary. I know they're not secondary, but, you know, he took us there with the words, but they were almost secondary to the actual...
So it had more to communicate.
Energy or dynamic or whatever that was conveying. I'm probably not using the words that I want to use.
I want to say where we are in the class right now is
yes.
We still just want to grasp what this place of relativity, which I think is significant because a lot of our culture, and particularly if you study things at university, you end up in a relativism where you find that there's nobody finally who's going to stand up and say, this is the truth.
Mm.
It's against, I don't know if you know, it's against the law. It's against the law now, virtually, to say, this is the truth.
About anything.
About anything, except there's a cup on the table. If you can photograph it, perhaps it's the truth. But anything that you might have to say about the human condition, about the meaning of an event, about somebody's motives, about what time is, about what space is,
about historical events,
about the meaning of history, about the causes of the First World War, about the values of the Labour Party, the whole structure of our life, there's nobody is allowed to say that this is the truth. The BBC, it's in law. The BBC is not allowed to say that this is the truth. If you dare to say that anything is the case, in the media, in the news media, then it has to be immediately that somebody who disagrees with it is allowed to disagree. And it's never allowed for the media itself on the television for a third person to come in and say, and they were right. Because of course it would destroy political discourse if we did that.
You can say to the best of my knowledge though, can't you?
Yeah, you can equivocate about
computer science or whatever, so he's more likely to
be. You're in the bounds of possibility, but not truth. I wonder if you just I'd like you to review the world we live in, and if you've ever been to university, I'd like you to review if you've done anything in the humanities, in philosophy, you'll discover that truth has become something archaic.
The truth can't exist in a world where things change, like absolute truth can't be in a
Let's bring it down to the table, right? I want to bring it down to the table because, in effect, Henri Bortov wants to say this is the truth of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's not saying I'm just giving you a theory of meaning here. Isn't that interesting? This is one possible theory. He's saying this is the way it is. That's why he wasn't employed in a proper university.
Mm.
You know, if you dare to say this is the way it is, you end up having to teach in the Free University of Brighton.
Well, you run out of town.
You can't. No, you're not allowed to make any definite claims towards saying anything that's true. So, as long as you say it's. I believe it. This is my belief. You equivocate, but if you say that this is absolutely the truth, it's for our culture. It's reminiscent of the Middle Ages. It's reminiscent of church and the authority of the church and having to absolutely believe in something. We threw all that away. But it's deep in our culture now that everybody's opinion, everyone has a right to their opinion, and there's no absolutely right opinion. We're just in a big soupy sea of opinion.
And everyone has opinions about people that they don't even relate to.
Yeah.
Like everyone will be in a room talking about a disabled person, but there is no disabled person in the room, but yet everyone's really opinionated about it. I don't know if
Well,
so when it enters the law, and we have the leader of the free world using the same argument, then
we're coming. I just want you to get a feeling for relativism, for there being no fact of the matter beyond physical facts, beyond empiricism. We're empiricists of the 17th century. So if you can measure it and weigh it, it's there. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. It's just a matter of
so
an opinion.
So that's kind of saying that that's the truth in polygamy. Why don't he's considered the heretic? Well,
it's not. I'm just because I get the sense that people are saying, well, what's relative is obviously false. I'm not sure that you realise that our whole culture is just a soupy sea of relativism. Wouldn't it be amazing if some great teacher arose on BBC One tonight and said, "Let me tell you, humans, how it is on Earth. Let me explain it all. Let me tell you all of the nonsense, all of the lies, all of the opinions. This is how it is. This is why you're born. This is what happens when you die. This is what meaning is. This is the truth of subjectivity and objectivity. We live in a world of opinion. I should have called it opinionism rather than relativism. The world of opinion can only survive. You can only continue to hold opinions in the absence of truth. And we've come to accept as a culture that. And all of these philosophical questions, the things that matter, we can't decide that there is no truth. We haven't decided that arbitrarily. We've decided that because as a culture we've utterly failed to find any truth convincing isn't the right word. Something like convincing.
It's charismatic, isn't it? I mean, the Bible and the scriptures, there is a charisma behind it. You shall not murder, you shall not be, you know. This is morality, this is how to do things, you know.
But yeah, I think we have to grant religion.
And there's no more of this kind of.
But I think we have to grant religion, the founding of a religion, when a religion is living, that the people who. A part of a living religion are in touch with something back there. They haven't just read it all in the Bible and said, "Yeah, whatever you tell me, I'll believe." You know, that's what we were left with, right? We were left with the dead dregs,
yes,
of something.
And even for your own self, you know, sometimes if something occurs to you, you think, "God, that makes real sense. I'm going to write that down so I don't forget it."
Yes.
And you do it, but then 2 days later it doesn't mean the same thing anymore.
Yes.
What it evoked when you thought it is gone. So
yes.
You think, if I keep repeating it, I won't forget, and then I'll just have it.
Yes. No, but often those moments occur in another state of consciousness. And then you try and you come back down into, I say down, but you fall back into ordinary consciousness, and the two, they can't live. They're oil and water, right?
But it's just words, then, isn't it? It's just,
yeah,
words, like
just,
the Bible or whatever.
Yeah.
When people,
yeah,
we just left with the dead words, like,
yes.
And people can use that to wipe out civilizations and oppress people and burn people, and because it's.
We're back to the gloomy world there. But you know how it is. There's something like, you know, the truth is a strange thing. You know, something like the truth that we're here just to see the blackbird or the robin in the morning, just to see the beauty of the blackbird and the robin in the morning. Do you see that's the truth?
Yeah.
Do you see what kind of thing that is? Do you see, what do you do with... What do you do with that? Someone else explains, "Oh, no, it isn't. It's not the truth. It's bloody rubbish. You know, what do you mean we're here to see the birds? I mean, I've never heard something so wet and wishy-washy in my life. Do you see, that's right. We've got oil to suck out the earth. We've got money to make. I've got to get him a Land Rover, you know. But do you see, in the moment that you see the beauty of the bird, it's the truth. Do you see, truth isn't like it isn't like some proposition that every mind is going to agree with. It's almost a state of realization where to see truth, you have to be in the corresponding state of consciousness that knows that that's true. Do you see? There's something that in our ordinary everyday state, you know that the phone's on the table, but you don't know about the beauty of the bird. But there's a place where the beauty of the bird in that place is kind of analogous to you seeing the phone on the table. You don't need anyone to prove it to you, because it's you immediately have the knowledge.
But then whether or not it's true at the time doesn't matter to you when you see the beauty of the bird. That's irrelevant. It's striving after truth and things.
It's a different kind of... Yeah. It's a knowledge, right? But we know nothing of this virtually.
According to what I read, stuff beauty is whenever beauty is the sign of the devil. Beauty is deception.
Yes, but do you?
That's like in a lot of religious teachings.
Yes.
Well, I suppose that's if you fall in love with someone's exterior,
that's
kind of
just
beauty.
The image, isn't it?
Yeah, but do you see?
Scared of losing you to enjoying your own, if you're enjoying the beauty of the bird, or the beauty of a woman, or the beauty of a man, or whatever, you can't be told now what to do because you're too much enjoying yourself. So you need to be told that beauty is the son of the devil, so that you will come to church.
Back. I hope you just got the sense. That if you see something's true, it's a kind of a direct communication that in the moment. And then you come down like we just did, and the brain freezes it and makes concepts and puts it all together into an argument and says, no, it's not true. Not true for me. One of the things that we lack is a knowledge to be able to discriminate between different levels of consciousness, because in a way our reflective rational consciousness doesn't know any truth. It's kind of true for it that the only truth it knows is that the phone's on the table. So it's not, it's true for it that there's no truth, that no metaphysical truth, because If you see any deeper truth, it's because you've left that state behind, and yet we all end up back in it.
So is that the left brain again?
I would not want to say that. I think if there's anything like truth, if there's anything like truth, then it's above the lot. Then there's number three, if you like, one, two, three. So, because there's this dualism of the left and the right. I'd rather put it Gurdjieff-wise. Gurdjieff has three brains actually. It's only when they're all working together that there's a unity within which another state of consciousness can emerge. So it requires that they work together before you can get some deeper insight.
And then it's not one or the other. Yeah, it's four.
Yeah, it's not. It's the two. It's the two having working together that makes. I mean, Gurdjieff is saying the same that all of our systems, if you like, if they work independently, they work badly, and they only you only actually have a clear mind and a pure heart when your system is unified. Otherwise you just have a bunch of emotions and thoughts that don't lead anywhere good.
How can we not work though? I mean, how can everything evolves and grows into what it is and seems to work. And I don't understand how we need sort of people's ideas to be applied to us to try and make us work like we're all busted. It's really weird.
Well, we're not busted, are we? We're just rolling around on the earth doing what we're doing. It's not really a matter of being busted. It's a matter of enjoying your life.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying your life, if you're not enjoying your life, why not? Those are the sort of better questions. Doesn't mean that you're busted. Because I agree there. If you take on board, and I did when I was younger, a kind of a narrative, that's like a narrative. There's something wrong with me, and I need to be fixed.
Yeah.
But I guess at a certain point in my life, the narrative changed to there's nothing wrong with me, but I tend to forget that. It's a case of amnesia. I'd rather see it that way around. Although you're looking at the same picture, I think it's already done. You don't have to make. You have to assemble anything new. It's already done. It's already okay. I'm already the being that I am. But there are certain states of forgetfulness of that. So relativism, if you accept it, then you lose any idea of there being a unique meaning to the work. In fact, the work just becomes whatever anyone wants it to be, which means every time someone reads it, there's a new work. Now, and I know you're all rebelling against that. I've got that, right? And I'm in a way, I feel, because you're all rebelling against it, I want to make relativism, I want to defend it, you know. I want to say, no, it's quite a reasonable position. And in a way, it is, you know.
So it's like a catalysator in a chemical reaction or something. Going to, if it meets those elements, it will create this molecule.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just think of the brain and the whole the materialistic understanding of things. You know, you just present somebody's eyes with this stream of text, and a whole bunch of stuff happens in my brain according to the structure that's there already, and that's the meaning of the work. And a whole bunch of stuff happens in your brain according to your structure, and that's the meaning of the work. Different brains, different meanings. And there's no experience of meaning in the work itself. There can't be a single meaning, because every brain it goes into, something different happens. You know, a complete kind of physicalistic understanding of things leads to the same sort of nihilism, which is partly why we've ended up without any truth, any sense of truth, because the only truth we accept is, you know, good old physical stuff. That's the truth. You know, I forget the philosopher who, after reading Berkeley, saying that everything is just the essence of everything is our perception of it. I refute it thus, and he kicks a stone. You know, that was the refutation of idealism, is that when you kick a stone, it hurts. It doesn't refute idealism, but it's our culture is, it just believes in the material, in what you can measure. So let's recover from relativism, shall we?
We need healing, John.
Yes. So neither objective nor relative. So, and we're already there, really. If the meaning of the text is actualized and comes to presence in understanding now, instead of being a replication of what had once been present in the author's mind. Now, do you see that leads to possibly to relativism?
Yeah.
Once we say we're not trying to reproduce what's in the author's mind, the old binary thinking says, oh, well, then it's, if it's not what's in the author's mind, it's what's in my mind. And we're trying to find a middle ground here. Are you with me? So that it meets with our deep intuition that there's something wrong with relativism. So the differences of the meaning in the meaning of a work which appear on the different occasions of its actualization must belong to the work itself as actualizations of the work's own possibilities of meaning. So he's trying to introduce an idea here that a work of literature, a creative work, isn't a fixed, static thing. It's a kind of a capacity to produce meaning in the people who read it.
Like the rose being diverse.
Yes. It's a capacity to produce meaning. It isn't a fixed meaning. It isn't even a meaning. It's a capacity to produce meaning. And it's not as if all of the possible meanings are kind of hidden in it. Do you know, when you read the work, then that's something utterly unforeseen by the person who wrote it, the how it's going to manifest in you. But it's still the work that's going to manifest. But it's the work doesn't have a meaning until it manifests in you. And yet, what manifests in you is a response to the work. I mean, I think that's what we were all trying to say when I was trying to convince you of relativism, isn't it?
Tarot card.
Yes.
Somewhere there.
Well, tarot's going... Well, we won't go into tarot.
No,
says Nicola. Nicola seconds that. Instead of this being the fragmentation of the work into a sheer multiplicity of meanings, which is what relativism was, these differences are, quote, and most of these quotes are from Gadamer, by the way, I've just taken out his name, the work's own possibilities of being that emerge as the work explicates itself, as it were, in the variety of its aspects. So instead of there being only a single meaning, or alternatively no more than what Gadamer calls a mere subjective variety of conceptions, there is the meaning of the work being itself multiply as differences of itself. Do you see, we've got to embrace a paradox here, because there are multiple, people experience different meanings of the work, and yet it still has to have possess some kind of unity. This is what Bortoff and Gadamer are trying to understand. How can we grasp this? So what is needed is a new idea of the one and the many, in which, instead of either or, it is possible for the very same thing to be both one and many at the same time, like the plant.
Or a stem cell.
Pardon?
Stem cell is a body that can
yes.
Any...
Yeah, or a stem cell.
Yeah.
So we've got plenty of examples in life, in living life, but... In a way, we're saying the text is a product of living life and has and inherits that capacity to express itself in different ways. And it's very much like a plant, the analogy he wants to draw. I feel like I should hurry. In that a plant will grow differently in different circumstances, according to the nutrition in the soil and the light and the wind and the plants around it. And if it's overshadowed by a tree, it'll grow in... You know how plants adapt themselves to the environment in which they grow? There's a similar analogy going on here for the work itself. Its meaning is going to manifest itself, but it's like your system is like a kind of a soil in which it's going to manifest itself. But it's still the work that's manifesting. And it's to understand what it is, it is to understand its capacity to manifest differently. And this is a capacity particularly of language. although it's also in the visual arts, but we're looking particularly at language, the idea that language itself is not fixed, that we don't live with this computer fixed meaning of words. It's part of the ability of a work to manifest differently is that language isn't fixed in its reference. And certainly not when you put words together in a sentence and you get a new meaning out of the sentence. And then you get a clause and the meaning of the clause. All of this is an extraordinary creative act. And language itself isn't fixed. So you're dealing with a living product of living beings, even though, you see, we're fooled by the text because it becomes thingified, it becomes objectified. But not as soon as we read it, do you see, it's just been temporarily stored there. As soon as we read it, it's back in the medium where it lives, right? The medium is our human intelligence.
So it's the same as if you just heard it immediately, except that it's been on pause, so it's as fresh as when it was written, and that's why it seems so fresh.
Yes.
It is as it was spoken.
But it's... You see, the words, the symbols themselves represent words of language, and language lives too. The language of Shakespeare is no longer our language, and yet there's a continuity leading all the way back to the language that Shakespeare used, because we're in Hamlet now, of course. Do you see how all of the shades of the meanings and the references of the words that Shakespeare used have changed over the centuries, and yet we still see Hamlet? Because he wants to say, where does Hamlet exist? And I think we were discussing this earlier, weren't we, about your reading the play and then seeing The Death of the Salesman. Because a play is a great example. It doesn't live, it isn't present, it isn't a play until it's performed. Reading it doesn't work. Gets you some way there. Reading it out loud gets you closer. But there's a form for the play, and the form for the play is actual people on stage doing the actions, enacting the play. And you see Hamlet as an example, or a play as an example, makes it very clear that there is no original Hamlet. There's no, you know, you might say, well, what about the day that in the Globe Theatre where it was first performed and Shakespeare was there and he'd informed Burbage about how to perform the part? Wasn't that the original Hamlet? No, obviously not, right? Because they would have performed that over several nights. Which one was the original? They were all a bit different. We don't think of a play like Hamlet as having a unique being, do we, in that way? It's only ever present to us when it's enacted. And even then it's strange, isn't it? It's like a piece of music. No particular moment of the play is Hamlet. It's the entire presentation.
So maybe it's like a snowball, and it gets layers and layers and becomes more and more real with time and the more part of our culture it is. Because he had to write it, it didn't exist until he wrote it, and
yeah.
It wasn't a thing, and he invented it, but now it's a very definite thing, and it means lots more,
yes,
to us as sort of cultural artifact.
Yeah, there's loads of stuff. There's what Shakespeare means to us, and then there's all the personal stuff, you know, as well. There's the last time I saw it was performed outdoors in the South Downs, so there's all the atmosphere of that in there, and it's each one of us. And there's you know, if you watched Upstart Crow on the no?
The kids watched one and they thought it wasn't very good because we wanted to watch it because of David Mitchell. So maybe it gets better.
Upstart Crow is a comedy about Shakespeare, which, you know, I don't say you have to watch it, but if you sneak on iPad, all the series is there. After a while it's just quite amusing. It's another, for me, I did enjoy Upstart Crows, so there's a whole other layer now to Shakespeare that's come from that being done about Shakespeare. And this is just accumulated and accumulated, and Shakespeare's become a kind of almost a legend, hasn't he?
He's the image of England.
Yeah, he is. And abroad too, you know, he's a, you know, if
and he didn't write like side notes or instructions of how Hamlet should be performed, or his tone, his features, nothing.
No.
Just Hamlet.
He didn't actually physically
write. Now I want to get on to something difficult here, which is, I found it difficult as I was reading it, which is now he's going to introduce an idea which almost brings us back to square one, which is that, and maybe you've found this, that somebody can ruin a play. I mean, generally they ruin it by actually changing the language. But various things have been done to Shakespeare plays, setting it in a different time, editing it, getting rid of certain bits, shortening it, changing the language so it's easy to understand. And there's a certain point which Bortov wants to say where you start becoming aware that you're in the presence of an interpretation of Hamlet, not Hamlet. But if you know Hamlet well, you can see this Hamlet's there and something else has been put on top of it. But the problem here is where, so who decides?
Yeah. You decide.
The director.
No, a decision comes from you. You just become aware of this decision.
But no, we're back in relativism, aren't
yeah.
we? Aren't we just about, I mean, he doesn't say this, but we're just about to fall back into relativism. I say that's an authentic interpretation of Hamlet. No, it's not. So who's right? And how do you determine that? I'm sorry to introduce that to you it's almost like a real philosophy class. You know, a real philosophy class would be, and I want you to go away this week, and I want you all to have an answer to that question, because it was troubling me. And Boris is going to go before I tell you what I think, aren't you, Boris?
I will come back.
Yes.
Thank you.
This. So it is too, and I feel like I have to answer this question. You know, finally, there's some very unsatisfactory answer here, which is that we each have to answer this for ourselves. Don't we? You know, the best I can come up with here is it's to do with your own, the consciousness you bring to bear when you see this play or read this book or confront this work of art. Whether you're truly receptive to it or whether you're projecting something onto it.
Absolutely.
And I mean, unravelling this, it seems to me, it would be possible to unravel it if you had a group of people who are sufficiently phenomenologically educated to know what that distinction means. And then you could bring to bear with the person who had the interpretation that you think it doesn't belong to the work, I think it would be possible as a group to come to some kind of an agreement that wasn't in the original work. I think it would be possible, but very, very hard. And it would require the utter devotion of everybody to maintaining the truth of the work, and not being attached to your particular view or understanding of it. Because if it's true to the work, it should be possible for other people who are genuinely receptive to see, ah, you're right. There was something in there that I hadn't seen before. It's been revealed to me. Or that same group of people could say, no. It's your mother. You see, it's your feelings about your mother you've put onto that. Do you know that? I think it'll actually have to come down to that. You'd almost have to probably psychoanalyze the person who's projecting a meaning into it and say, no. Or, you know, I feel Freudian about it, or Jungian. This is your personal unconscious. Do you see? Something happened to you in the past. Your mother was unfaithful with your uncle. You know, that's what Hamlet's about. And that's caused you deep feelings of hatred towards the Queen and anger towards Hamlet. That's totally distorted your understanding of the play. You know, I think you'd have to go to that level. But I think well, if that wouldn't, if you've actually, you know, you've understood or projected some figure from your own life into that character. And then, you know, if you're the director, you then distort the play according to that. It should. I feel it's something. Yes, it's interesting.
So, which I would add, maybe that is the authentic interpretation, because William Shakespeare at the time, it projected a character into the play himself.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. See, now you're arguing for relativism.
Yeah.
Now you're the relativist.
No, I know, but so I'm saying. It's all inauthentic, and all you have is our interpretations. And you could go and see a globe, whatever, interpretation of it. Or, you know, maybe... Yeah, I'm not quite sure. You'd have to categorise it in a different way.
So, just quickly, I'm quickly over to Alex, and I'm saying with Alex, well, an inferior work of art may have been, you know, inspired by something like your personal experience, but in order for it to be a genuine work... It has to travel back into that place that the death of the salesman did, into the collective. And the collective experience of humanity does contain bad mothers. You know, Hamlet might be, you could say it might be a play about a bad mother. And insofar as that, as Hamlet is about almost the archetype of the bad mother, and it speaks to everyone, not just to someone who, not to someone's particular experience, but to all of our experience, then you can say, yeah, it's a... But you see how... I mean, that's why this is problematic.
Yeah.
Yes.
What if you're a woman and you're going to change the lead character to also be female? Because of the time that we're living in, because we're in the movement of feminism, is that more authentic? Because you're making it relevant to the times and the world around you?
Don't know. I'd have to see the play. See, again, I mean, if it's a projection of feminism onto Shakespeare, who knew nothing about it, then it's I'd say it's a making use of Shakespeare, and you've made something new out of it. But it's not Hamlet. Do you know? That's not to say that it's not a work of art, but you to use Hamlet, there are ways of using Hamlet to create another work of art that has something different to say.
So an example of that...
Yes.
That you're talking about, Delphine, at Christmas, they did the Christmas Carol.
Oh, yes. Did you see it?
I've forgotten the... It's Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. And it was an amazing rendition. It was done by the guy that did Peaky Blinders, and I haven't ever watched Peaky Blinders.
It?
So it's on the telly. It's on iPlayer.
Try iPlayer.
And it was in three
Christmas
parts.
Carol.
It was
recommended.
Done in three parts, and it's a really modern rendition of the Christmas Carol, in which it does bring in the feminine, the oppression. You know.
Don't spoil it though.
No, but and the interpretation of Scrooge, and it's done in quite. Although the theme's the same, but it's done in quite a modern way. But not modern, not like modern here, but the themes are all modern that come through it. And it's brilliant. It's brilliantly done. And you really get that, and you think, gosh. And you know that Dickens would have really appreciated that. because it was brought to life now, how we are now.
Yeah.
So it's worth. Yeah, it's worth.
But it wasn't. It wasn't.
I mean, I don't know why I'm talking about that.
No, no. I thought about this too when we were looking through the slides, because, but it was a new work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was. It was one of those things you say inspired by. It's called The Christmas Carol. It's got the same, the names of most of the characters are the same, and the events are similar, but they've been changed in such a way where you would say it went beyond. It almost this it was a strange. You could say that it almost peeled a layer off what Dickens was saying, and went even deeper. It was quite extraordinary. In that way,
yeah.
But you so much so that you say, no, it's not an interpretation that's attempting to be a Christmas carol. It was something inspired by. Do you know, there's so many ways you can go with this.
Mm.
Yeah.
What you've just said, John, brings to mind, I'm wondering if Bartok has got anything to say about these layers of meaning.
Mm.
You know, like the surface narrative, and then... You know, I referenced the Buddha with the sutras, where different people hearing the same story, it's meant for different levels of consciousness.
Yes, yeah.
You know that
yes.
kind of idea.
Yeah, there's, but that's like dreams. You know, if you're going for dream interpretation, dreams have layers. Your own dreams, there'll be a certain layer where you say, oh yeah, that's about what happened yesterday. Yes, and then there's another layer where you say, oh yeah, no, it's referring to my, you know, my work life. It's symbolically referring to something that's happening in my work life. And then there's another layer where you say, oh no, it's got something archetypal to say about the whole human condition, and yet it's all the same dream. But dreams are just brilliant at that, and works of art too have that capacity, particularly. When they're telling a sort of a story that on one level you can say, oh, it's just a little drama. And then suddenly, you know, and it could just stand as a drama where you're just interested, what's going to happen next? Oh, that was quite entertaining. And then you see the next level down.
But isn't this sort of like, so that's our culture now doing that.
Hmm.
So, you know, all is not completely lost in that people aren't, directors or writers or script writers or writers of books, you know, authors and...
Yes.
It's not all lost. I mean, we're saying it's... You're saying you are kind of indicating it's all lost, but it's not completely lost because some of these things come through and I read quite a lot and what people write isn't all about, you know, that it's all... You know, they've got the capacity to give meaning.
Yes.
In the play, on the thing, the TV program, reading something like A Grief is a Thing with Feathers, you know, which is an amazing, you know, little book of an incredible perception of what grief is. You know, the people are there, somebody's there.
Yes.
There.
Yeah, no, it's all... It's,
no, it's not in politics.
Yeah,
no,
I mean, but it's not lost, is it? I mean, it's out there. It's
yeah.
it's in the bookshops. It's in the.
But not only that, because of all the time that's happened,
plays,
you know, what's happened on Earth. We're ahead of Shakespeare and Dickens. You know, we've gone collectively. The human race has gone deeper. You know, you might say deeper into error, but nonetheless deeper. So that a really profound work of art now is even more profound for what we've been through. Do you know, there are depths now that we can express. I mean, Christmas Carol is a brilliant example. If you compare it to the depth that Dickens could get, which you suddenly see, oh gosh, we can resonate more deeply now. Even though we don't, most of the time. Do you know, it's somehow our capacity for depth is quite extraordinary. Our capacity for insight is quite extraordinary. In the background of how we look at the world and say, oh my God, I feel like something in the psyche has been dug out, and we have the capacity for quite extraordinary insight in us. as a result of what we've been through, as a result of the First and Second World Wars.
And psychology, I think,
as well. And, yeah, of Jung and Freud and Heidegger. You know, all of these people, what they've seen and written, has gone into the psyche. It's there, you know, and the psyche is now richer and has a deeper meaning in it than it had before. Even though we look at the world and we're just living on a certain layer, that isn't the bigger picture. And every now and then, you know, something like that program on the TV, suddenly it opens a window and you say, oh, look. Isn't it? How did that get through under the radar? You know. Now, the authentic interpretation. I've kind of left it open, but I was working on it. I feel like there's something I want to say before we have our break about language, which is important, which I'd like to leave you with. So I'm just skipping a couple of slides. It's to do with the nature of language and meaning, which is what is unsaid. In everything that we say, there's a background. There's an obvious level of the background being you're in a class and it's called language and meaning. And I'm John, and you've seen me in previous weeks. You know the sort of things I say. You know why you're here. You know it's 2:15. There's an enormous... Do you see? An enormous context of your knowing where you are that is informing what I'm saying. It's informing my saying it and your hearing it. But not just that. Everything that I say, in a way, is like... I'm taking a journey... and I, at every point, I take a fork. I could have said that, but I said that. And what am I going to say next? And it's like somewhere there's a quite an immense speed of the possible things that I could say, and I don't say them. I choose to say this. And in a way, in me, and probably in you too, there's the echo of what wasn't said. And often that echo is an idea in you. You know, I said something and I'm sure you get that. Something occurs to you as a result of what I've said, but I'm off there. I didn't say that. But it the same unsaid... Do you know that you can almost see Heidegger calls it a network of significance within which one's speaking. And every word is a distinction that highlights the things it's distinguished from. And it's all to do with... I mean, it's the right brain again. You know, it's all to do with the background. If I say background, I mean foreground. Do you see? If I say background, I'm already indicating the foreground, but I'm indicating the foreground in the background. If I say white, I'm saying black. I'm saying not black. You see, every word has what it's distinguished from in it. And every choice of word is like taking you in a certain direction. And then there's this whole network of associations that every sentence that I utter evokes in you. And that network changes over time. Different in each individual, and the culture itself changes over time, and different cultures are different, and all of these are the unsaid, in which whatever it is you're reading or hearing, it's being thrown in there. Do you see what an amazing thing language is, and how if you could go back to the beginning of the class, how the idea that you could take a text, and it could have a unique meaning for everyone is utterly impossible, because the text is like it's like the iceberg. It's just the little tiny bit sticking above the water. Yes? And under the water is all the background, all of that's not unsaid, echoing. And every sentence we utter is like that. And I mean, I feel like looking at Anthony again and saying, and you realise that if ever you try and write any kind of program code to process language, because everything we say is so ambiguous. It's not ambiguous because you know you're in the room, you know who I am, you know what time of day it is, and all of that background knowledge pairs away all the ambiguity, and what I'm saying kind of makes sense to the situation we're in. But if you just plonk a machine here, it's got no knowledge of the context. And when you, if you write program code, it's then that you realise, but there are about, you know, 15, 20, as you explore it, 30, 100, 150 different ways that you could interpret what this sentence means. And even, forgetting that it might be a joke, forgetting that it might be irony. Do you know how we play with irony? How just with a little tone of voice, we let everyone know it's not serious. Yeah, that this is a joke and this isn't. And the whole way that the gesture of the body, the atmosphere, all of this is the unsaid. And you place a work in that, right? Do you see how absurd? And then the work isn't the meaning. The meaning is what emerges from having placed the work into the context, and then it's what emerges from that. But even then, you're only aware of the meaning that appears. There's still the context that the work has created within the context of where you actually are. You know, even the context of the work is within the context of I'm in my bedroom and it's late at night, or wherever it is that you're reading. Do you see the way that language is misunderstood by what we're going to pick on the left brain? What the left brain thinks is, it's just a collection of words, all fixed, and the meaning of the text is like that. Yep, it's there are 20, you know, whatever it is, 50,000 words. That's quite a lot of words, and they correspond to a very complex meaning. Okay. But there's a corresponding meaning. But the 50,000 words, if you like, are being dropped into this place where there are just trillions of ways that it can manifest, uncountable ways that it can manifest, and none of them are. You can't say that it's subjective either. Do you see? It's the interaction of the work with wherever it's placed that produces the meaning, and the work is the capacity to do that. The only complication, which we've already looked into, is whether you can allow the meaning to manifest within you without stuffing it around. It's a left-right brain thing again. It's almost like the thing you're supposed to do is allow the work to settle in you without the left brain interfering with it, without the left brain taking pieces and thinking about it. Later left brain, you can say. But it's not. The left brain has got to be there. It's got to pay attention. You can't read without the left brain. You can't take the words in. It's just a matter of, it has to be a kind of a portal into which you allow the work to come into you, and then you allow the response to happen. And then that's the work working on you. But that doesn't mean that you can't or won't distort the work. That's the question. I keep looking at you, Anthony, as if you particularly feel this, because I feel it. Do you know? It's because it's almost like we've got to have this other magic test. Oh, you're very receptive, yes. But is anyone actually 100% receptive? Can you ever have a utterly pure receptivity? Not sure. I'm not sure that there's perfection here. You know, that there's always going to be some kind of layer of personal interpretation that you've placed on it.
And how much you know of the world, like you say, all the things that something isn't. So if you know, say, a lot about roses and someone mentions one particular rose, you have a different response than if you know nothing about roses.
Yes, exactly.
The alternatives are fewer, so it means something different.
Or yes.
The only flower you've ever seen is a snowdrop, then all flowers would be like a snowdrop, so you'd only perceive the flower as being.
Yes, yes, and of course there's a whole thing there where you would say that there's certain works of art where you just, there's whole sections of it that you just miss because you don't have the background.
It's okay, but you can still get something. It's like when you're a kid, or even now, when you read books and some of the words you don't know, but you gloss over them, and you know eventually how you
you
work
you skip
out what words mean by the context that they're in, and after seeing it a few times, but you still get the sense of
But the other, I mean, the thing, the other great thing about a great work is that you come back and read it again and it's brand new.
Yeah.
It all starts again. And there's a whole new, particularly, I mean, I find this with good philosophy. It's not exactly that it's a new work. It's there's another layer now. You suddenly see, was it Marina you were saying that there are levels? You had a certain level of understanding of it, and it was okay, and there was whole bits of it that just didn't reach you, and you don't know they haven't reached you, because they haven't reached you, and then but the next time you read it, suddenly it's reaching you, and you say, oh my God, how did I miss that?
Sometimes you did get it the first time, but you've forgotten because we watch TV, and I say to my kids, da da da, and they go, you said that last time.
What about my classes? I think I'm seeing something for the first time, and then I hear a recording, and I think I said that last year. Not this class though. This is a new one. Okay, I think that person coming to the door is a signal.
Yeah.
It's time to go. Bye, everyone.